I have found. Some who have written about, he was a Baptist pastor apparently, who was very exercised and didn't know about the assemblies, and finally when he saw him he said, that's what I've been looking for. But it's balanced. It's written in a very nice style. There's nothing arrogant about it, and he doesn't skim over the surface and make it appear that the assembly where he is or the assemblies as a whole are just one step short of heaven. I think it's an excellent book to give to anybody who might be exercised along these lines. Very well balanced, very well written, and I notice he has written another one called Is the One Pastor System Scriptural? Maybe we should read a lot more about this in our assemblies today, because we're headed straight for that if we're not careful, and it will be a step in the wrong direction in my estimation. I haven't read it yet. I hear it is also excellent. These books are worth having. All right, Habakkuk, after a multitude of diversions and all kinds of things happening in between. I hope Henry didn't get run over by a streetcar or something. He isn't with us. It would be tough on the streetcar. All right, Habakkuk. Let's settle down. The Babylonian period, I think, by the way, we have to be careful about these dates. Careful not to become too dogmatic about them, because there are all sorts of variations. I've been asked about several dates, and I wouldn't stand over any of these dates to the last decimal place. There are even differences about where and when these dates started. But just to give a vague idea, it's marked here as somewhere around 625 to 595. The important thing is that his ministry went over, rode over into the Babylonian period. Those of you who thought worthwhile to have one of these little chart things, not made by me, I got it out of a book somewhere, but it shows that Habakkuk began, or Habakkuk, whatever way you want to pronounce it will be alright with me, he started ministering after the northern kingdom went into captivity at the very end of that period, and his ministry went right over into the Babylonian period. Now, in talking about the Babylonian period, please remember that there were three invasions by the Babylonians, and we have to keep that in mind. These three mark what is called the Babylonian captivity and the period of what's known as the desolations of Jerusalem. Now, in between, if you look at one of the other charts, you will find, or even here, you will find that there were three kings, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jeconiah. There was a Jehoiakim and a Jehoiakim. I call them Tweedledee and Tweedledum, because they were puppet kings anyway, and they weren't worth tuppence, any of them. They were set up by the Babylonians. They had their names changed by the Babylonians. That is the degree that Israel had fallen to. Can you believe it? God's chosen people being ruled. You see, they took the last legitimate king off the throne. They wanted one that would be a kind of a proxy for them, and so they stuck in one of these puppet kings. Now, one of them only lasted for a very brief time. Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim are both down as in 610. Jeconiah in 599, one of them only lasted for a matter of weeks. Now, the reason for that is that apparently the Babylonians put in kings that they thought would pacify the people. They were actually descendants of kings, but God had preserved his own men in the background. And some of these men directly descended from Josiah, the last really legitimate king of Israel, turned up in the third or fourth generation to be one of the men who came back to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple and the city. But that will give you some idea of the confusion of this time. Now, these men put in by the Babylonians, the reason they didn't last very long was they were put in by the Babylonians so they could pacify the people and keep them loyal to the Babylonian power. But when they got in the throne, they started getting a bit cocky and started rebelling. These prophets were begging them to submit themselves to the Babylonians. That was their message, because God had permitted it. Humble yourselves under the hand of God. The other prophets who went along about the same time, and I want to say just a little word about that, these men, as well as prophets who did not write books, begged them. They said, this is the disciplining hand of God. If you submit yourselves, if you humble yourselves, if you accept it as the judgment of God, God will lead you back in his plans. But they wouldn't listen to that, so they turned and tried to revolt against the Babylonian power and got destroyed as a result. Finally, the Babylonians became utterly fed up with these fractious Jews, and so they sent a third invasion in, and they just leveled the whole place with the ground, took the last of these kings down to Babylon, poked his eyes out, and that was the end of that. So these men who overlapped, and of course Habakkuk was one of them, and possibly Obadiah, but the three major prophets, you will notice, who overlapped into this time, of course, were Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Now, the fact that God used these three men in three totally different places has always, to me, been a great lesson of the wisdom of God. Daniel was taken down into Babylon and became a courtier. God put him right in the palace. Ezekiel, he was in a totally different position. Jeremiah, he was left with the remnant in the land. Ezekiel was not in the palace in Babylon, but he was with the captives, the slaves who had been put down to work by the canal of Kibar. Now just think of these three men. They're all servants of God. One is with the slaves in Babylon to encourage them to keep their eye on the coming day. One is in the palace, Daniel. One is back in the land, left with the riffraff, the lower classes of people, and left, of course, with the foreigners who swarmed in to take over the land after the Israeli people were removed from it. Can you picture yourself as being in any of these positions and how difficult it must have been? And which would you have chosen? To be with the slaves by the river Kibar? Ezekiel? To be with Daniel in the palace, but also in the lion's den? Or to be with Jeremiah left behind to encourage the riffraff that had been left? They weren't worth taking away. He took all those who could have led revolts, everything like this. They were deported to Babylon, but there were quite a few left behind. But they were the lower classes, usually. And somebody was left there. But God had his key men in all three places. And when the time came for the rebuilding of the temple first, and then the city, Jerusalem, the walls and so on, Ezra, Nehemiah, and the rest of them, God stirred up the hearts of these men. It was all, they were left in these positions over a period of 70 years in the desolations. And I see the hand of some of these men, particularly Daniel. Daniel never came back as far as the scriptures go anyway. He didn't come back. He was a very, very old man at this time, when they came back to rebuild, that is. But who were the men who kept the fire burning? Who were the men who kept the torch alight through those dreadful 70 years? Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, each one in a different place, each one up against terrifying difficulties and threats and dangers. And each one, just read Ezekiel. Now, of course, he saw the departure of the glory from the temple, a heartbreaking thing, but he also soared to see the rebuilding of the millennial and even the eternal temple, whether you take it as literal or spiritual. I leave that up to you, and please don't ask me any questions about it either, because I won't answer them. These men kept the torch alight. Zerubbabel, who came up with the first lot, his name means seed of Babylon, or born in Babylon. Nearly all the men who returned were, in fact, men who had been born during the 70 years. But who taught them? Who taught them about what the temple should look like? Who taught them the ways of God? Who taught Ezra, for example, who was a ready scribe in the law of the Lord? Who taught him? These were the links. There were links in between. Daniel and his companions, other faithful men, and there are long links. And when they finally come down, Ezra was the fourth generation from the high priest who found in the temple, when they were cleaning it up under Josiah. You remember they discovered the book of the law of the Lord, the Bible, that had been lost. Ezra was the great-great-grandson, the great-grandson of that priest. And the same thing is true, of course, of Zerubbabel, the leader who came down and became, we say, the secular leader of the people. He was the great-grandson of King Josiah himself. But there were men in between who in the dark, dark years taught these men, kept before them the truth. There is coming at the end of the 70 years, there is coming a restoration. Men must be ready for it. These are the men, nameless men, many of them, in between, who were the links, who taught Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, all these men, Zerubbabel. Who taught them? We don't know. But somebody did. Because they knew all about the temple, they knew all about the cleansing of the priesthood, they knew all about the sacrifices, they knew all about giving. There had been teaching men in the darkness who taught them. Now you can see why I'm telling you this, can't you? It's these unnamed link men that God always has in place, and maybe you are one of them. And when they came back with knowledge. Daniel was in a palace. Ezekiel was with the slaves. Jeremiah was down with the remnant. And do you know what happened to Jeremiah? He warned them, don't revolt, don't revolt, don't revolt. Bow to the judgment of God and learn by it. They revolted anyway. He said, don't go down to Egypt. God has forbidden you. Don't go to Egypt. They defied him, and they went to Egypt, and they tied him up and took him with them. And as far as we know, poor Jeremiah died in Egypt where he had told the people not to go. Yours will not be an easy task. But if God gives it to you, for God's sake, do it, whether it's easy or not. Now, if I don't say anything more to you today, I wanted to say that and get it off my chest.
Amen.
Now I look at Habakkuk, or Habakkuk, or whatever. Have a cookie. Think of it as have a cookie. He was contemporary with Jeremiah at home and with Daniel abroad, probably as Zephaniah was, and of course they would also overlap a little bit with Ezekiel. He ministered right up to the Babylonish captivity of Judah, and the conditions outlined in chapter 1, verses 2 to 4, reflect the state of the nation during the reign of Jehoiakim. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see, O Lord, how long shall I cry? Thou wilt not hear. Even cry unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Why dost thou show me iniquity? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are those who rise up in strife and raise up strife and contention. Therefore, the law, the Bible, the book of God is slacked. It's not the law, it's just something that's there. If you want to obey it, you obey it. If it's not, it's slacked. It's not important. It's not the last word. And justice doth never go forth, righteous judgment of things. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous, therefore justice goeth forth perverted. Behold among the nations, and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which ye shall not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess and to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. Now this was the first of his ministry, therefore it was before the actual attack of the Babylonians, whether the first, the second, or the third. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards, and are more fierce than evening wolves. Their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from afar. They shall fly like the eagle that hasteth to eat, tear up the carcass. They shall come all for violence. The set of their faces is forward. They shall gather the captives as the sand. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be a scorn to them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. Then his mind shall change. Then shall his mind change. He shall pass over and offend, imputing this power unto his God. So he is foretelling the sin even of Nebuchadnezzar, who would go over the bounds God had set for him. God set for him to take the people into captivity, but he became arrogant, and God took him from the throne and made him crawl around like a beast. So, looking at our notes, he ministered right up to the Babylonish captivity. Conditions outlined reflect the state of the nation during the reign of Jehoiakim. The style and form of the book is unique, though somewhat like Jonah, in that it is a history of Habakkuk's own experience. Jonah's is a history mostly of outward happenings and experiences under God's hand to bring him into line with the divine will, while Habakkuk's is principally inward wrestlings and problems expressed in the form of a dialogue between Jehovah and himself. The book deals with apparently unpunished evil, then the way in which God punished it, and the instruments he used, and finally the course of the believer or the remnant in the midst of these conditions. these are explained as follows. Even though in grace delayed, the moral judgment of evil is certain. Now that's one of the lessons we have to learn from this man. That is chapter 2, verse 5 onward. Yea, also because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as Sheol, and is as death, cannot be satisfied. Verse 6, shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. Shall they not rise up suddenly that shall bite thee, and awake that shall vex thee? Thou shalt be for booty to them. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee. Because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein, woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Thou hast plotted shame to thy house by cutting off many peoples, and hast sinned against thy soul, for the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber. In other words, the very wrecked houses will beg for vengeance against you. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood, and establisheth a city with iniquity. Verse 14, the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That is quoted elsewhere. Woe to him that giveth his neighbor drink, and so on. So, doom, God's justice, God's vengeance for his people will come. He is assured of this. In the waiting time between, the just shall live by his faith. The end of verse 4, chapter 2. The just shall live by his faith. This sums up in a few words the attitude of the believer when things all seem to be wrong and when God doesn't seem to be intervening in the affairs of men, whether it be in the U.S., in Canada, the U.K., Russia, Bosnia, wherever, Africa. That's where the real suffering is today. 1,000 people a day are dying in the war in Angola alone. There are more people in Angola with legs blown off than any other country in the world. They can't even get limbs for them, because there are somewhere between 1 million and 3 million anti-personnel mines still buried in the country, and they don't know where they are by the conflicting powers. So people go into the fields to work and get their legs blown off. They're buried in cemeteries, so when they go to bury their families, they get their legs blown off, and some of them, of course, are killed. The country is in desperation, and it's only one of the many countries of Africa. There is hardly an independent nation in Africa today which is not either at total war within itself or else gasping on the very brink of dissolution, the independent countries of Africa. Now we look at this and we say, why doesn't God? And we have to come back to this verse. The just shall live by his faith. We have to hand it over to God. We have to hand it over to God. If we can do something to help them, we gladly do it. But that doesn't solve the basic problem. Why it happens, why God permits it. And we don't always know. He can see the end from the beginning, but I can't. Neither can you. So we have to leave it in faith in the hands of God. Now that is the basic lesson, and that is the key verse to the whole book. The just shall live by his faith. A, the prophet is concerned that violence and apostasy, that is violence of the Babylonians and apostasy by the Israelites, are all around in the nation, and God appears to be doing nothing about it. That's the catch. That's the clincher. That's what's hurting him. God didn't wipe the Babylonians out. God didn't judge the people who were tormenting the godly among them at all. It just went on. He, that is the prophet, is disturbed that when God does begin to judge, he would use a wicked nation like the Chaldeans to punish his own people. Chapter 1, verses 12 to 17. You know, you could have punished us some other way, but why punish our wickedness by an even more wicked country? This is a mystery. The Lord's answer to A is that the instruments of his judgment, that is the Chaldeans, are on the way to carry out his work, which will be certain and severe. And 2b, he answers that though he uses the Babylonians, he will also punish them for their own wickedness. 1:11 and 2:5-10. God is supreme and uses whom he will. We only see a very, very short time ahead. We don't see the whole picture. God sees the whole picture, but we certainly don't. And we have to leave it to him. We sometimes think we cheer on heroes. I remember during the Hitler Wars, World War II, which was, of course, a whole bunch of wars all put together. But I remember when Russia tried to invade Finland, and there was a general there called Mannerheim, Field Marshal Mannerheim. And this massive Russian army plunged into Finland. They were going to tie this little nation up and tie a string around them, and that would be it. And they had miscalculated. The weather was against them, and their big armies in straight lines were simply surrounded and left to starve by Mannerheim's Finns, who were accustomed to the snow and the ice and who worked on skis, and the Germans were bogging down in their big boots. And they couldn't do the goose step there in Finland. And all our people were cheering on, poor little Finland, and here's this Mannerheim, wonderful man, son of God. He almost sprouted wings overnight. Now the Russians had to back off and go away, and they came back again, fought again, and overwhelmed the country. Then it turned out that Mannerheim was a Nazi through and through. And he was only defending the country because the Germans wanted him to do so. That is the Germans of the other side. It was the Russians who had invaded him. And here we had been all the time cheering on the wrong man.
You got Rush Limbaugh here in America.
You see, it's so easy to do that. And we change overnight. We suddenly discovered that this marvelous Field Marshal von Mannerheim, he was nothing that we wanted, but we thought he was at first. Isn't it better just to step back and say, Lord, you know what you're doing, and let it go at that? And of course, it's the same in many other situations. I notice in your country that before a president gets into power, he's an angel of light. And once he gets into power, you discover all the things that are wrong with him, with his wife, with White Waters, and with all the rest of it, and he turns into a very devil. But we thought he was great beforehand. You're going to be disappointed no matter who, no matter what. I'm but a stranger here, heaven is my home. Earth is a desert drear, heaven is my home. I think that's the long-range view that the Christian should take. We are citizens of a better country. All right. The end of salvation and blessing for Israel. Chapter
David, can I see something that I see in this that's not often promoted? I see in the first chapter here it says, O Lord, how long shall I cry? And verse 3 says, why do you show me iniquity? Cause me to see trouble. For the plundering and violence are before me, there is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless. These are all things that he sees in his own country.
Yes.
And most prophets, they have to declare God's message, you know, about other people. Okay, but Habakkuk is unusual in that he has to ask God, how long is it going to be, God, before you make things right? He really questions, the patience of God in allowing these evils to continue on, not in other countries or in wickedness of Babylon or something like this, but right there in his own assembly, you might say. You know, how long are you going to allow this to go on, God? And, how long are you going to allow these problems to continue? And I heard you say before, and I know you said it in jest, but it's actually a truth, isn't it? Sometimes people have to die. Sometimes people have to die, and then your program moved on that honored the Lord. And that's what I think Habakkuk sees here. He sees all these problems. And we have them here today. There's so much that's going on inside of each and every assembly that is not honoring the Lord and is not at all Lord-centered. You know, sometimes you wonder, how long is this going to continue on, or is this going to stay, you know? And
right.
How can this be changed?
He did also, of course, pray about the problem of Babylon attacking. You know, why would you use these godless people to punish your own people? So he had two problems.
Yeah.
One, the evil of Jehoiakim and the people under him, because they really had reached the depths now, the Israeli people. They were on rock bottom. God couldn't wait any longer. But then he also had the problem, of course, of the Babylonians. Why do you use these wicked scoundrels to punish us? So he had a two-pronged one. But then God lifts him up to see the end is salvation and blessing for Israel. Chapter 3, verse 12. Thou didst march through the land in indignation. Thou didst thresh the nations in anger. Now he's talking about, this is a prophetic statement. Verse 10, the mountains saw thee and they trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by. The deep uttered its voice, lifted up its hands on high. He sees the future. The sun and the moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows they went, and at the shining of thy glittering spear. Thou didst march through the land in indignation. Thou didst thresh the nations, plural, in anger. Thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people, even for salvation with thine anointed. Thou woundedst the head out of the house of the wicked by laying bare the foundation unto the neck, Selah. And then he goes on to describe some of the things that will happen in a future day, but we can go back to that in a moment. God's ways, a D in that inset, the end of salvation and blessing for Israel, which carries over and is a picture of the ultimate and eternal blessing in store. In God's way, Israel's blessing would also bring blessing to all nations. In the period before, and while this is worked out, however crooked and arrogant all may be, including the instruments, God's own just one lives by faith, trusting that his God will do the right thing, and waiting for that which, though it is long in coming, will not tarry or be hindered. And so, that is really the end of it. Look at the last verse or two of that chapter 3, the end of his whole prophecy. although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines. The labor of the olive shall fail, the fields shall yield no food, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord is my strength, and he will make my feet like hinds' feet. He will make me walk upon mine high places to the chief singer on my stringed instruments. You see, this was set in poetic form. No matter what, there may be drought, there may be famine, there may be no figs, no oil, no olives, no grapes, no anything in the land, yet I will trust. Now, Job said something very like that, did he? The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He had to be able to look over the present into the future. Ezekiel saw the very presence of God withdrawn from Israel. He said he saw the glory of God rising from between the cherubim. He saw it hovering there. He saw that glory going out to the threshold of the house and hovering there, as though loth to leave. Then he saw it, the glory of God going over to the east, over the Mount of Olives, and it hovered there for a while. And then the glory of God disappeared over the desert and was gone. But was that where he stopped? No. God gave him a view of the millennial temple and the eternal temple. And whatever way you look at that, Ezekiel, in the midst of dire distress, when even the presence of the Lord was taken from the nation. That's a dreadful thing. That's a dreadful thing. That's Ichabod. The glory is departed. But he still had to live on there, in a spiritual desert. And that's where he had these wonderful visions of the future. Brethren, we simply must keep our eyes on the future and the Lord of the future, and not get ourselves in a tizzy about what's happening today or last Tuesday. That's the way we have to go. So there's a little outline then. Note four classes are aimed at. Chapter 2, verses 9 to 11, the covetous. 2, 12 to 14, the unrighteous. 2, 15 to 17, the shameless and the intemperate. 18 to 20, the idolatrous. A suggested analysis. 1 to 21, faith tested. 2, verse 2 to 3, verse 15, faith taught. And 3, 16 to 19, faith triumphant. Note the woes that are pronounced on five specific things, or six if you count cunning. On rapacity, that means greed, if you will. The desire to plunder and rob and take whatever you get your hands on. Pride, tyranny, baseness, cunning, and idolatry. We can always take these things and apply them in our own context. Now, our cutoff time is, oh, it's 12:15, so we have about 15 minutes to go. Anything? Yes, there's a question here.
Brother Long, this may lead into a subject that you'd rather not discuss right now, so feel free, or maybe at another moment. Habakkuk 2:4, behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith.
Yeah.
I want to read a verse in 1 Timothy 5:18. The last part of the verse, the laborer is worthy of his wages.
Yeah.
There's a seed that has been sown in our neck of the woods. I don't know how far it's going to go. Concerning the Lord's servants who, in quotation marks, live by faith. You know what's coming.
Yeah.
And we have been told that the Lord's servant does not live by faith concerning his financial support. He should have a wage. It's the just that live by faith. What's your reaction?
So what does just mean? Just Jimmy? Just Alec? They live by faith, but I don't have to. I would like a salary. I am a very firm believer in the ability of God to supply the needs of any servant of his anywhere, anytime. Now let me say, as a kind of sideline to that before I go further, that does not release the Lord's people from their responsibility to support those who are laboring around them, among them, or even somewhere else about whose need they may be exercised. It's no good if I am a businessman, which I'm not, never have been. It's no good my saying, oh, I don't need to worry about him because the Lord will take care of him. He lives by faith. But it's just as bad if I suggest, well, why don't we give the guy a salary? Because, of course, then he becomes our employee, and that's all wrong. You see, that's the problem with this whole concept of a paid pastor. Whether you call him a full-time worker or what makes little difference. Doesn't matter what name you put on it. But he who pays the piper calls the tune. And when men are paid by a congregation, they have to be very careful that they keep in line with their congregation. Because if they stand up and say, hey, everything is wrong here, we've got to get down and clean this mess up, it's quite likely that those who pay him are going to say, you weren't paid to split this place to pieces, you were paid to do God's work for us. I'm not going into the whole angle, of course, that this releases other people from their responsibility to work. I'm talking now, as I believe Brother Don has in mind, about these two sides of the thing. The just shall live by faith does not release me from my responsibilities toward the servant of God. That is, if God lays it on my heart, if I see a need in a brother who is serving the Lord, or if I am in the area, the assembly, or the district, or the province, or the state where he is, and I know here's a servant of God, and he needs help, I can't simply say, well, the just shall live by faith. I am responsible. Whoever is there and sees this need is responsible. So, just a minute, Henry. I would like to finish what I'm saying. I, for example, have heard it said, and I mentioned this somewhere recently, even Schofield says in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 that Paul is defending his apostleship. I don't think that's right. He's arguing that since he is an apostle, he had as good a right as Peter and the other apostles to require that the people there support him. Have not I and Apollos, are we who haven't the right to be supported while we labor among you? Are we the only ones who can't take along a believing wife, a wife who is a sister? In other words, if, and I'm not, I know this puts me on kind of thin ice, but never mind that. If if Paul had been a married man with a wife, which he doesn't appear to have had, but if he had, or if Apollos had, then the assembly was responsible, if he needed his wife along, to see that they had the wherewithal to get there. And you find all over Paul's writings, he uses a word which means to see on their way or to set on their way. Now, it occurs about 12 times, I believe, in the New Testament, but I'm just speaking now from memory because I didn't expect this to come up. of the 12 times that that comes up to see them on their way, twice, maybe three times, it means that they accompanied him on part of their way. They saw them to the boat. They saw them round the corner. That's what they call an Irishman's good night. You know, in Ireland, so often somebody's visiting in a house, and after they've chatted for a while, he says, "Well, I must go. Well, I'll accompany you to the corner." So they go to the corner and they talk and they talk and they talk until it's too late. And then the first one who's on his way home, he says, "Well, I'll take you back to the door again." So he comes back to the door and they...